This week on The Score, Hurricane Florence lands on the East Coast. Law professors ask, can free speech be progressive? Virginia's ACLU releases reports on solitary confinement and women in the criminal justice system. A former federal prisoner tells her story. Stay tuned for all this and more on The Score.
You're listening to The Score from Bering Drift with your host, Rick Sincere.
In the most jeopardy would be Virginia, North Carolina, South Carolina, that area. And again, they haven't seen anything like what's coming at us in 25, 30 years, maybe ever. It's tremendously big and tremendously wet. Tremendous amounts of water.
Welcome back to The Score from Bering Drift. I'm your host, Rick Sincere. Top of the news this weekend is Hurricane Florence, landing on the North Carolina coast and bringing winds and rain to states from Georgia in the south to Maryland and the District of Columbia in the north. This week, I spoke with Virginia's state climatologist, Jerry Stenger, at his office in the Department of Environmental Sciences at the University of Virginia. We talked about Hurricane Camille, the most destructive storm ever to hit Virginia, and about hurricanes in general. Here's state climatologist Jerry Stenger. As we're sitting here, we're 24 to 48 hours out from the projected landfall of Hurricane Florence, which is supposed to be one of the strongest storms to hit the Atlantic coast. From a historical perspective, what were the worst storms to hit Virginia in the past 100 years or so?
Well, one of the storms that stands out in people's minds, and we're actually at the 49th anniversary of that storm, roughly, is Camille. Mm-hmm. It came ashore along the Gulf Coast as a Category 5 storm. And as it moved to the north, it slowly lost its energy and lost a lot of its tropical characteristics. But it still carried a huge amount of moisture with it and a lot of uplift and instability. As it moved north, it interacted with a cold front that was coming down from the north, and it moved along that cold front and got more or less hung up in the mountains of Virginia, the Blue Ridge Mountains. And the thunderstorms associated with that became what we call terrain locked. That is, they continue to feed themselves and stay powerful without really going anywhere because the landforms around it help to bring in moisture so that it keeps being fed and can rain buckets over small areas. And that's exactly what happened. There are reliable surveys taken after the storm that indicate that 30 plus inches of rainfall came down from this storm, most of it within less than a 12-hour period. And this caused a scouring of the land right down to the bedrock. And you can still see the scars from this today, where the soil was completely stripped from the rocks. And we still have these bare slopes mm-hmm. on the mountains today. And that caused tremendous loss of life and destruction. And it's estimated that one out of every 17 people in Nelson County died that night. Wow. That is really the landmark storm that hit Virginia. But interestingly enough, it was not a hurricane when it hit Virginia. It was the remnants of a storm. And this is why we always have to watch these things, because just because they're not a hurricane or tropical storm again does not mean that they can't be a real problem. So this is one of the reasons why we have better radar now, and we have a lot of people who are more weather conscious and pay attention to these things. And the storm Florence that we have now is really partly a cautionary tale that says these things do happen. We're lucky. It seems like the forecast is moving it further to the south and reducing the impact here in Virginia. But when we look at the situation with Camille, we see that really awful things can happen, and it's important to be prepared for these things and pay attention.
We're at the University of Virginia talking to Dr. Jerry Stenger, who's the state climatologist for Virginia. What is the role of a state climatologist? What do you do in that job?
For the most part, each state climatologist does whatever is appropriate for his institution, his situation that he's in. So there's quite a bit of variability in what state climatologists do. But for the most part, it's similar to my situation, where I do climate and weather research that primarily impacts the state of Virginia. I do background research on things that are of interest and seem important. But I don't always get a lot of time to spend on that, because the phone rings or I get emails and people need answers to certain questions. I've given people help in the legal realm, medical realm, interviews with the media, and just people that call up with problems, construction companies concerned about construction delays, people that want to build some sort of industry in Virginia need to know what the climatic conditions are going to be. I had one group that wanted to build a golf course and was concerned about the weather for golfing, and I did an analysis for them. So it's quite interesting. It's one of the great things about the job is every day is what they used to call it, anything can happen day. And on top of that, we have storms like Florence that pop up, and that completely wrangles everything that I've been doing. So everything else has to go on the back burner, and I wound up doing a lot of work with an emerging situation, and all the people are concerned about that.
Well, just talking about Hurricane Florence, which is on its way from the Atlantic to hitting the United States East Coast, several states from Maryland to South Carolina have declared a state of emergency. There's a federal state of emergency in place. But the storm seems to be changing course. So what can you tell me about predicting the direction of a hurricane like this and how it can change hour by hour?
The premier source of information about tropical systems, hurricanes and tropical storms, is the National Hurricane Center. These are the people who have all the models that are tuned for tropical systems. They have people that have a great deal of familiarity with these things, so they can brainstorm and combine output from different models and come up with a projection of what the storm's going to do. And in general, they do an excellent job. This hurricane, Florence, is actually not far off the current forecasts are not far off from the forecasts over the previous days. There's a little change in the fact that it's turned to the left, which has a big impact on us. Unfortunately, it has a big negative impact on the folks in South Carolina. But this is just an indication that even if you have really good forecasts, things can change very quickly because there are so many subtle influences in the atmosphere that really are not fully understood. We can't really completely predict what they're going to do. And in this case, we have a little wave in the jet stream that is moving through a little sooner than expected. And that's part of what's kicking the storm further toward the west. And in this case, we're very fortunate. Declaring states of emergency is probably a very reasonable thing, given the fact that the variability about these forecasts can be quite high. And to use the adage, it's better safe than sorry. Mm-hmm. And again, it's a cautionary tale. We need to take these things very seriously. One of the biggest problems is, as the storm was moving along on its originally forecast track, there was an increased likelihood of a lot of water being piled up in the Hampton Roads area. And when you get this happening with a slow-moving storm, you can inundate places where a lot of people live. And the question then becomes, do you evacuate these people? And evacuating everybody from the Hampton Roads area would be a nightmare at the very least. So it's a real problem for emergency planners to decide, when are you serious enough about the forecast? When do you trust it enough to know exactly what decisions to make? And that is up in the air.
Mm-hmm. A slow-moving storm like this accumulates a lot of moisture, I'd expect, so that if it were to change its course and hit central Virginia, where we are right now, our worry would be more lots of rain than lots of wind or thunder and lightning. And I remember Hurricane Isabel, which was about 15 years ago, we got a lot of wind here in Charlottesville.
Yes.
So what's the difference between those two types of storms?
Back in 2003, the remnants of Hurricane Isabel came marching through the center of Virginia, bringing with it gusty winds, not terribly high speed, probably on the order of 30 miles per hour, but gusting up to 50 or more, and plenty of rain. Now, this came at a time when there had been a lot of rain before, so the ground was nearly saturated. We're putting more water on the ground and making the ground completely soggy and creating a lot of runoff. And I remember clearly my mom lived in the Richmond area at that time, and I stayed with her overnight when the storm came through. And one could see the trees coming down because the ground was so wet and the gusty winds were just rocking them over and over. And so many trees came down and power poles came down. Mm-hmm. And she wound up being without electricity for about 2 weeks. And that was a bad situation for her. And this is typical of what can happen if we get a combination of a lot of rainfall on top of a lot of rainfall, and then we get some moderately strong gusty winds. One of the biggest problems, the two biggest problems, are flooding. Low-lying areas can get flooded. Higher elevation areas can be subject to flash flooding. Mm. In urban areas, the stormwater system can be overwhelmed, and you get street flooding and such in the urban areas. But one of the other big problems is the fact that you can topple trees like crazy. When you start knocking trees down, you start knocking power lines down. And then things get really ugly. And with Isabel, enough of the state was affected at one time that getting crews to go in and reconnect the power was a real problem. They were bringing in people from all of the country, basically, to come and help restore power. And it took quite a while to get everybody back online. And this storm, had it moved further to the north than it's forecast now, could well have done the same thing over a huge swath of Virginia. And that's one of the big concerns, because we have had a lot of rainfall, and the ground really is saturated. Now, it looks like we're still going to get about 4 inches or so here in Charlottesville, up in Waynesboro. It still looks like we might easily get about 4 inches of rainfall here in the Charlottesville area. Up in Winchester, probably a little less than that, but still, we're dealing with saturated ground. So one has to be very careful if one's driving on a roadway that has that goes down to a low-lying area, because you might just wind up with a big puddle that you shouldn't cross. That happens on a lot of rural roads around here. Also, if you're in the higher elevations, you have to be aware of the potential for flash flooding. And I think a lot of people in those areas are already aware of that, and they know how to take precautions about that. But one of the big things, again, is you could have power lines down in some areas simply because the ground's so wet to begin with, even though the winds are not forecast to be particularly strong.
If I hear you correctly, what you're saying is pay attention to what your local weather forecasters say and pay attention to local emergency management, and then that's how you stay prepared.
As Ben Franklin said once, some people are weather-wise, most are otherwise.
You're listening to The Score from Bering Drift with your host, Rick Sincere.
We will have the rest of Jerry Stanger's conversation with The Score later in this week's show. Now let's shift gears. On September 11th, the Cato Institute in Washington hosted a panel discussion on the question, can free speech be progressive? The idea for the discussion came from an essay written by one of the panelists, Georgetown University law professor Lewis Michael Seidman, who prefers to be called Mike. I spoke to Professor Seidman after the discussion at Cato, and then to another panelist, University of Washington law professor Ronald Collins. In this short segment, we'll hear first from Professor Seidman, then Professor Collins.
Professor Seidman, we're here today because you wrote an article asking the question, can free speech be progressive? What prompted you to ask that question? And then in a few words, what's your answer?
I think the immediate prompt for it has been a dramatic shift in free speech law in the Supreme Court. It has been kind of appropriated by the right wing of the court, and it's being used in the interests of deregulation. And what I wanted to think about was whether that is a complete aberration or distortion of free speech law, or whether it has roots deeper in the history and philosophy of the First Amendment.
And what direction is it going? What direction would you like it to take?
I think that the Supreme Court mostly mucks things up, and so I would be happy if there were a kind of mutual disarmament and both the left and the right stopped trying to use the court to achieve political objectives. If you ask the question, which direction are things going, it seems to me pretty clear that the balance of power has shifted pretty dramatically and may shift more to the right as Trump makes more appointments.
It's interesting. That's the first time I've heard President Trump's name mentioned today in this whole panel discussion. But he's a major player in this debate.
He certainly is. And as with so many other things, the president makes things unpredictable. We are on the verge of a constitutional crisis, and it's anybody's guess what the Supreme Court is going to look like when we come out on the other side.
Thank you for your comments today. I really enjoyed the panel discussion.
My pleasure. Thank you.
The Score is produced by Bering Drift, Virginia's top site for news and politics. To learn more, visit BeringDrift.com.
Professor Collins, towards the end of your first remarks here today, you asked a question, and I hope I wrote it down right, about whether truth can prevail in the marketplace of ideas. Is the answer yes, and if the answer is no, what can make truth prevail?
Well, truth can prevail sometimes, but obviously, you know, we've learned from history that it doesn't always prevail. I mean, as Holmes said, it may well be that truth is best tested in the marketplace. It may well be that that's the best place to do it. But that's not to say that it always will. The fact is that sometimes people's passions overrule their reason. It is sometimes happens that prejudice prevails over decent human values. These things happen. Holmes was aware of it. He was willing to take the risk. This is why when Hugo Black said we must not be afraid to be free, the reason we fear it is precisely because the experiment can go wrong, precisely because it can undermine our values. This is the experiment that the American Constitution has committed itself to. Is it the best one? Perhaps not. But it is the one that we as a nation have committed ourselves to.
The question we were here today asking was, can free speech be progressive? What's your answer to that?
Yes, it can be, but whether or not it can be the law of the land is another matter. I think, as I said, that when the framers drafted the First Amendment, part of the deal was you leave your ideological baggage at the door. So if neutrality doesn't permit progressives to have a First Amendment view that they agree with, the same thing holds true for conservatives. And that brings us back to the very problem that gave rise to the First Amendment.
And you and some of the other speakers made a distinction between First Amendment law or doctrine and First Amendment or free speech sensibilities or culture.
Yeah.
What is the difference?
Well, first of all, our rights, or as we exercise them, are not limited to Supreme Court doctrine. I mean, day in and day out, people exercise all sorts of free speech freedom in the culture of our society that well exceeds what the law of the First Amendment may or may not permit. So there's the First Amendment doctrine, that is the law, and then there's the First Amendment, what we the people do with it. I mean, if you just go back to the Revolutionary era, there were many things that people were doing that were not consistent with the First Amendment, and they had passed laws to prohibit political speech and punish people, and yet the culture, notwithstanding those criminal sanctions, thrived. So, you know, it's one thing to have the free speech doctrine, it's another thing to have the culture of the First Amendment.
Well, thank you for your comments today.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Happy to.
Did you miss a previous episode of The Score? Look for our podcast at BearingDrift.com.
When The Score comes back, we will talk to the executive director of the Virginia affiliate of the American Civil Liberties Union, as well as with author Kemba Smith, who found herself caught up in the federal criminal justice system. And we'll hear the rest of my conversation with Dr. Jerry Stanger about hurricanes. You'll be surprised at what he says. Don't go away. The Score returns in a few moments.
It's tremendously big and tremendously wet. Tremendous amounts of water.
Do you have an idea for future episodes of The Score? Write to host Rick Sincere at ricksincere@gmail.com. The Score is produced by Bering Drift, Virginia's top site for news and politics. To learn more, visit BeringDrift.com.
Welcome back to The Score's Stormy Weather Edition. I'm Rick Sincere, and I write for Bering Drift. Earlier this month, the ACLU of Virginia held its annual membership meeting at J. Sargent Reynolds Community College in Richmond. The theme of the meeting was Women Ensnared in the Criminal Justice System, which is also the subject of a recent research paper released by the Virginia ACLU. At the end of the meeting, I spoke with ACLU Executive Director Claire Gastaniaga about that report and another one, which focused on the practice of putting prisoners into solitary confinement in Virginia penal facilities. Here's Claire Gastaniaga. The ACLU of Virginia has recently issued two reports, one on solitary confinement in Virginia prisons, one on women in the criminal justice system. Let's start with the women. What are the conditions that women face when they get into prison in Virginia?
Well, actually, the reports are different because the women's report focuses on the pathways that women follow to get to prison. Mm-hmm. And we've illustrated in that report the need for a lot of additional information to really adduce and to understand the conditions issues that happen to women once they're in prison. I mean, one condition that got fixed in the last legislative session was that women had no access to sanitary napkins and other female hygiene products, and now they do for free. So that was one very specific conditions of confinement that affects, you know, only women. So that report is really much more about the pathways. How do women get there? What's going on? They're women, as Kemba Smith pointed out, more likely to be kind of victims of what we call the girlfriend syndrome, where they end up, you know, somehow interacting with somebody who's a drug dealer. That drug dealer has all kinds of information that he or she can use to bargain and plea, and then the girlfriend doesn't have any of that. And the girlfriend ends up actually, in many cases, being subjected to harsher penalties. In Kemba's case, she had the dual problem that she was in that circumstance, but also it was crack versus powder cocaine back when crack, and that's why she got a 24-and-a-half-year sentence in a circumstance in which they couldn't show that she'd ever sold a drug. So that report's really about how do women get there? Why are more women, why is the rate of women being incarcerated increasing? What gender-linked factors are there that we should be thinking about in terms of that aspect of increased incarceration, and how do we decarcerate by simply not incarcerating women in the first place in those circumstances?
We're talking right now to Claire Gastaniaga, who's the executive director of the ACLU of Virginia. Welcome to Bering Drift Radio, The Score. I should note before we go any farther, as a disclaimer, I'm a member of the board of the ACLU of Virginia, and that's how we got together. Yeah. Let's talk about that other report on solitary confinement, which is a very serious human rights issue.
Right, and that is about conditions of confinement, and we've been working on that for quite some time because we have an intake system. We get thousands of requests for assistance every year. A lot of them come from people who are housed in correctional facilities in Virginia and regional jails, state prisons. And they raise questions across the board about their conditions of confinement. Everything is from, you know, a lot having to do with quality medical and dental treatment, and then a lot having to do with the use of solitary confinement. And this administration, we wrote our report, we talk about solitary as essentially any kind of confinement that results in 22 to 24 hours of isolation in a cell by yourself a day with, you know, limited access to other inmates, social interaction, or even exercise. The administration says we don't use solitary, but we use administrative segregation. We use protective custody. We use restricted housing. We use all these things. So we wrote this report, and we basically said, look, we should never use solitary confinement for anybody for any reason more than 15 days. It causes mental illness. There's no question that it causes mental illness for people. People are social creatures to be isolated. And we wanted to hold up for all Virginians the reality that there are people who are being subjected to treatment that under international human rights standards are simply inhumane and violations of people's rights. Now, we've just this last week filed a lawsuit that concerns a particular inmate at Red Onion, which is, you know, both Red Onion and Walnuts Ridge were built as maximum security solitary confinement facilities. I mean, they're individual cells, and they're they're built to hold people without any roommates, if you will, and without access to a general population. But one of the inmates down there, we were collecting information, you know, from different people who've raised some issues around their conditions of confinement, and a number of the people who were incarcerated down there said, you have to talk to this particular inmate. You have to talk to this particular inmate. Turns out he's an inmate who's been there at Red Onion for more than 12 years, who's principally isolated because he doesn't speak English. And the person that we had down there that they kept saying, go talk to this person, was one of our bilingual staffers, who's our investigator, and he was able to communicate with this person. So we filed a lawsuit last week challenging his isolation, his solitary confinement, as violations of the constitutional prohibition against cruel and unusual punishment, violations of his equal protection rights, and violations of federal law that follows federal money into facilities like this that says you can't discriminate on the basis of national origin or language competency.
I can imagine some of our listeners right now are thinking, why should I care about this? These are bad people who, if they wanted to avoid this kind of treatment, they shouldn't have committed a crime. Why should we care?
Well, what most people don't recognize is that your conditions of a confinement are not determined by a jury. You know, that you get convicted of a crime, you get sentenced to a certain number of years, and your conditions of confinement are determined administratively by the administration of the prison. And in many circumstances, done by people who are essentially allowed to operate without real supervision. So people should care, because if you get convicted of something, it's not that the jury said that you should be sentenced to solitary confinement. It's because some administrative person in the prison doesn't want to provide adequate protection for somebody who they think needs protection from other inmates, because the prison doesn't have adequate facilities to treat mentally ill people, and so they put people who are already mentally ill in solitary so they won't be a problem. And for, you know, and to do management of individuals that, I mean, they say sometimes these are the worst of the worst, but, you know, frankly, it does not matter whether you're Lee Boyd Malvo, whether you're Jesse Matthew, or whether you're Mr. Reyes, who is our client in this new case. Your conditions of a confinement should depend on your behavior in the prison, not the kind of crime you committed.
How can we find a solution to this? Does it require legislative action or judicial action, or can the governor act on this?
You know, when we've been asking the governor, two governors now, by executive order ban solitary confinement in state facilities, and the governor could do that. The president did something similar by executive action at the federal level, and when he did that, we then asked then-Governor McAuliffe to follow that lead, to ban all juvenile solitary, and then to ban almost all adult solitary that didn't comply with the maximum 15-day rule and other, you know, humane limits on the use of restricted and solitary confinement. So the governor could, and we have an action. You can go to our website and take action and send the governor a message that you think he should ban solitary confinement by executive order. We also will be looking at legislation that will focus on getting more data out for the public to see about the actual use. Part of the situation we're in right now is we say one thing, and in our lawsuit we said several things that the administration has said are not true. And we look forward to having an impartial tribunal decide, you know, what the facts are. But, you know, part of the problem here is that there's very little transparency by the Department of Corrections. And so the public really doesn't have a basis on which to appreciate or even know what's going on down there.
Well, I appreciate your talking to us about these issues today. I expect this is going to be an ongoing process, so we may be talking to you again in the next year or so.
Well, we'd be very happy to talk to you again, and particularly as we move forward with the results of the Women in Prison report, where we said, here are some recommendations. We think there should be a statewide committee, commission, task force put together to really look at the question, why are women going to prison and jail at higher rates than men? What's going on? And we need the public to know why that's going on, and we need attention. And so the first thing that happened is somebody could accept our recommendation and put together a broad-based group that included people like the people who are on our panel today, who actually have, you know, experienced the system, and see whether we can't come up with some policy recommendations that would keep that from happening.
Oh, those are some big questions. But, Claire, thank you for talking to us today. I hope to talk to you again soon.
Always happy to do it, Rick.
Thanks.
In the interest of full disclosure, I should note that for the past 3 years, I have been a member of the board of directors for the Virginia ACLU.
You're listening to The Score from Bering Drift with your host, Rick Sincere.
One of the featured speakers at the ACLU of Virginia's annual meeting was Kemba Smith, the author of a memoir called Poster Child. She was convicted on federal drug charges in the mid-1990s and served 6 years of a 24-year sentence before President Bill Clinton commuted her term in 2000. I asked her about her book and her experience. You have a memoir of your time in prison, how you got to prison. Just tell me about your book, Poster Child.
It's a very personal, transparent account of my experience with my pathway into the criminal justice system. And basically, it started out with me being a college student and picking the wrong associate, wrong boyfriend, that relationship being abusive, and how that escalated into me receiving a 24-and-a-half-year sentence as a first-time nonviolent drug offender. Where the prosecutor said I never handled, used, or sold any of the drugs that were in the case, but yet and still I was held responsible for 255 keys of crack cocaine. And then it talks about my struggle from turning myself in, 7 months pregnant, and going into this crazy system and fighting for my freedom. And as I mentioned in previous audiences, and the fact that my parents are my heroes, they advocated for my release. And there was a magazine called Emerge Magazine that decided to highlight my story and make it its cover story. And that's how the community became aware of it. And then there were other media that did stories around it. And so eventually I did get commutation from President Clinton in December 2000. So I turned myself in 1994. I was sentenced to 24-and-a-half years. I wasn't supposed to come home until January of 2016, but because of the commutation, I came home December 2000 after serving 6.5 years.
We're talking to Kemba Smith, the author of Poster Child. Welcome to Bering Drift Radio, The Score. I appreciate your time today. Let's jump forward to that commutation. What was that process like? What did you have to do to get the attention of President Clinton so that he would sign that paper and release you from prison?
Well, I will have to get God the credit as far as orchestration. Basically, that's the title of my book. As far as Poster Child, I believe that God wanted me to be the poster child for this war on drugs gone wrong and what happens to first-time offenders, and particularly black women, because at that time the fastest-growing population within prison was black women. So it actually took that article that I mentioned previously to launch the black community being aware of it, and then the NAACP Legal Defense Fund took on my case pro bono. Elaine Jones was director at the time, and then there were national organizations that jumped on board, such as the Deltas, the Lynx, the National Council of Negro Women, that advocated for my release. But it was a huge effort outside of those organizations such as the ACLU, FAM, and there were individual people that wrote letters and signed petitions, and my parents were out there advocating, sharing the story. But basically it took a lot. I mean, there was no, this was an Alice Johnson type deal in the age of no social media, and I didn't have a celebrity advocating for my release, but thankfully it did draw the attention of the President of the United States, and I was one of a few that got their sentence commuted in December 2000.
In a very large way, you were fortunate that you had this kind of attention, this community backing. There are a lot of women in the criminal justice system who are languishing without any attention. What's your message to them?
My message to them is not to lose hope, and there is a huge formerly incarcerated network of people that are out here advocating. There's a formerly incarcerated conference happening next week in Orlando. There is a National Council of Incarcerated Women and Girls conference happening in Tulsa, Oklahoma, the end of the month, September 29th. So there are a lot of people who are advocating. Today I have a black wristband that says Free Michelle West. She was a friend of mine while I was incarcerated. She has a life sentence and has been in prison for over 25 years and was a first-time offender. She was denied by President Obama with her commutation paperwork. So there are women, several others, Alice Johnson, and men that deserve the opportunity because it's just been too long and they should come home. So just don't lose hope. There are people out here fighting for change.
My final question, because your time is limited, what kind of policy recommendations do you have in terms of changing laws, changing procedures, changing regulations? What do you think that the government should do to solve some of these problems?
There's a lot of trauma going on with individuals that lead them down this path to incarceration. I think there needs to be some type of connection with social services, with people being released from prison, so there could be proper counseling to deter the revolving door of recidivism of people coming in prison. I don't think the stakeholders involved take that trauma in consideration, in particular with women and domestic violence and the unhealthy relationships that lead down the path. But when we're talking about reducing mass incarceration in the United States, we also need to have a discussion of what we're defining as a crime. And in order to make these reductions, I do think we need to look at diversion programs, pretrial diversion programs that could maybe prevent so many people being tarnished with the scarlet letter where, you know, some people do get a smack on the wrist. Well, can we get a smack on the wrist and then let people still be able to continue with their lives without having a felony conviction that ruins their life and moving forward when they want to do better? So those are just a few things, but there's so many things because people have a hard time coming out and reentering and to get a job. It's like a major thing. So if you can't get a job, then you go back into that criminal lifestyle as well. So I just hope we start listening to human stories, humanizing this issue and not wanting to be so punitive and think of strategic ways where we can do things differently in this country and not ruin families' lives.
While we are on the topic of criminal justice reform, a few days ago I met up in Washington with Jake Grant, who writes for Young Voices Advocates. He had recently published an article showing how the war on drugs adversely affects state and federal budgets. He argues that changes in drug laws could save taxpayers billions of dollars. One of the themes of this week's program is criminal justice reform, problems of incarceration. You've recently written about the war on drugs and its effect on budget priorities. And why don't you just kind of lead us through the argument and what you were writing about?
Sure. So the federal government spends way too much money incarcerating people. I think if you look at the numbers, it doesn't really show that drug use has gone down. But that we're spending a whole lot of money trying to fix this problem of drug abuse. I think there are a lot of ideas as to what we can do to help alleviate the problem, and a lot of that involves helping the individual rather than locking them up and throwing away the key. Often we run into the problem of how to get people back into being a functional member of society, and locking them up and then giving them zero resources when they come out really doesn't help that problem.
We're talking with Jake Grant, who's with Young Voices Advocates. He's a contributor to their program of commentary on public policy issues. Give us a ballpark estimate. How much does the government spend on the war on drugs, and specifically on incarcerating people who are using drugs?
Well, it depends how you want to look at it. So the federal government spends millions, maybe even billions of dollars, but the state and local governments spend even more. There was a recent study that actually had the social cost of incarcerating people. So that would be all of the costs across the government, the people who are incarcerated, their families, and the communities is upwards of $1 trillion across the nation. So you can talk about the millions and the billions here and there, but I think if you add everything up, it's even more substantial.
So we're talking about $1 trillion, which is even more than Apple is worth, or Amazon.
Yes.
Where can we redirect those funds? What can we do to reduce the amount of money government is spending on the war on drugs and still achieve a better environment for people who may be abusing drugs?
Yes. So right now we're $21 trillion in debt, as you know. So just cutting spending is something that I think is important. Besides that, I think we should be redirecting funds to helping people get back on their feet after they are incarcerated. One thing that the House of Representatives has passed, the First Step Act, which gives resources to people who are coming back into the workforce after they've been released from prison to help give them resources to get back on their feet. I think if the Senate passed that, that would be something that would help save money in the long run. Because you're putting people away you're lowering the amount of people who go back to prison. The recidivism rate goes down.
One of the effects of incarcerating people is that you are turning taxpayers into tax absorbers. If these people were in their communities and continued to work in whatever job they might choose to work at, they would be contributing more than they would be taking away from society.
Absolutely. Yeah. So, I mean, I think the whole goal of putting people in prison is to make sure that they're not hurting other people. And once they're out, that's basically the state saying that they have the ability to become contributors to society. So when you help them and they're able to get a job and not rely on government assistance and not be forced into actually committing more crime because they can't find a job and feed their family, I think that puts everyone, especially the community, in a better place.
I know you have been waiting to hear the rest of my conversation with Jerry Stenger, Virginia State climatologist.
Is it true that Atlantic hurricanes begin as sandstorms in the Horn of Africa, Ethiopia, Somalia?
Interestingly enough, a lot of these strong hurricanes that hit the east coast of Virginia are what we call Cape Verde cyclones. They come off the coast of Africa, and around the Cape Verde Islands, they feel the effects of the ocean, and they blow up. They become far more intense, more organized. And these storms actually start off as collections of thunderstorms, often in East Africa, in, say, Ethiopia or Somalia. They may start out as a collection of thunderstorms, a loose collection. As they move across Africa, they may become a little bit better organized. And then when they move off the coast, they can become even more organized. And that's what leads to the development of a tropical system, is the organization of thunderstorms that starts circulating in a counterclockwise motion. And that's really how hurricanes get formed. So that's one of the big locations where a lot of these storms will start. And actually, that's where Isabel came from there. I actually have a little movie that shows a collection of thunderstorms from satellite photos, and you can see it move across and then slowly become more organized and gain a rotation and have an eye and intensify. The other big area where we get tropical system formations that affect us is in the Caribbean. Mm-hmm. So they're both very active areas for hurricane formation. But interestingly enough, some of the most intense ones that we have are the ones that have tracked across the Atlantic Ocean and had plenty of time to get well organized as they come across. And if they're not torn apart by the jet stream or some other circulation, they can arrive here with a lot of power.
Well, that's really interesting. It's sort of an illustration of the butterfly effect and shows how small our world actually is.
Our global weather, our global climate, and really the whole ocean atmosphere circulation, as we say, is amazing. It is interconnected in ways that we're only beginning to have clues about. One of the other interesting things, not necessarily a tropical cyclone, is the fact that a lot of the nutrients that come into the Amazon rainforest are actually blown from Africa. A lot of the Saharan dust and soil and such is actually brought over with the trade winds and deposited in the Amazon rainforest and helps to fertilize it.
Wow, I never knew that.
How about that? That's some researchers here in this department verified that this indeed was happening.
Well, that's a tidbit that our listeners will not have heard anywhere else.
This week, our From the Archives segment dates back to 2012, when I spoke to Virginia author Earl Swift at the Virginia Festival of the Book in Charlottesville. Swift is the author of Big Roads, a history of the U.S. interstate highway system and the road networks that preceded it.
My first question for you is, what sparked your interest in this topic? What made you write the book?
Well, the short answer is that I was watching a morning news show, one of the national news programs, and this guy was doing the weather, and he was standing in front of a map of the lower 48. And as I watched, I realized that it featured no topography. It had been stripped of topography altogether, and in place of mountains and rivers were the outlines of the states, a scattering of cities, and most prominent, interstate highways. It was, the country had been reduced to a grid. And I realized at the same time that that's pretty much the way I had come to see the place. And this was a bit of a revelation. And then in the course of the next several weeks, I had a number of mini epiphanies that were related, or that I came to see as related, one being that I could... I found asparagus, clementines, and strawberries, you know, fresh same time of year in the supermarket, and realized that that was a relatively recent phenomenon. And one thing led to another, and you know, it the effects of the roads, I guess, became more apparent to me than the roads themselves.
Mm-hmm. So. And so you made a proposal to a publisher? Or?
Actually, this coincided with shortly after the series of epiphanies. I had a proposal with my editor at Houghton Mifflin, and he took a little piece of that proposal and pitched it back to me, and that little piece was, why don't you do a history of the interstates?
Mm-hmm. And so how long did it take for you to write the book, or to do the research and the writing?
Insofar as it was his idea, basically, it took me a full year and a half just to figure out what the story was. Mm-hmm. You know, do enough research just to understand what I didn't know.
Mm-hmm.
And then probably a solid... another year of dedicated research, going to get, you know, I had to go all over the country to various archives to read people's personal papers and, you know, get the paperwork behind the story, and then about a year to write it. In total, wrote about 4 years.
Did you also do a lot of interviews, or was it mostly archival research?
Did a lot of interviews. Did interviews with transportation officials. I write for Parade, or I did at the time, wrote for Parade magazine regularly, and it helps to double dip, you know. So they assigned me, for instance, the story on America's crumbling infrastructure, so I was able to get interviews with people I normally would not have been able to get as just the author of a book, you know. So Mary Peters, for instance, and you know, Tom Warren out in Utah, who's really kind of a leading thinker, and you know, and then the relatives of all the main characters. I mean, I interviewed them extensively, and people who were involved in various incidents that are covered in the story. You know, picked the brains of a lot of academics. And
now, in your research, were you able to find any comparisons with how other continental countries like Canada or Russia or China deal with their transportation grid?
Not some. Well, of course, China's is all relatively recent. The problem is the hurdle to doing that is that that they're following our lead.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we really kind of. You know, the U.S. interstate system and the autobahns, for instance. I mean, it's a real chicken egg question as to which came first, because the superhighway network we have definitely was inspired by the success of the autobahns.
Last question: in the course of your research, what was perhaps the quirkiest fact that you learned that you didn't expect, that, you know, something that just you looked at it and said, wow, I never expected to learn this?
Well, there are a lot of those. There are a lot of really strange little turns. In terms of quirkiest, so many come to mind. You know, the fact that Eisenhower grew up with like 8 brothers and sisters in a house that was 818 square feet. It's crazy. You know, the whole business about manure. You know, that was an eye-opener.
Yeah, I wrote that down. Could you just repeat those figures? Because they were really, really eye-opening. It was something like 2.5
million pounds of manure per day, 60,000 gallons a year, and that equals 400,000 tons of manure per year.
And that's just New York City?
That's New York City.
So other places that had less public transportation as New York did at the turn of the century, because they had streetcars.
Would have more horses. Would have a higher horse per person, or, you know, people per horse ratio. Like in Kansas City, you know, it was like 18. Mm-hmm. So you got a lot of horses in Kansas City. So apparently Boston stunk to high heaven. It had a rich equine flavor, is the way people described it back then.
That's it for this week's episode of The Score. For all the writers and editors at Bering Drift, I'm Rick Sincere. Be sure to come back to The Score next week for more news, reviews, and interviews. And don't forget to tell your friends where to find us.
Do you have an idea for future episodes of The Score? Write to host Rick Sincere at ricksincere@gmail.com. The Score is produced by Bering Drift, Virginia's top site for news and politics. To learn more, visit beringdrift.com.